Hello, good evening. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. And I will be your host tonight with our continuing special coverage of the coronavirus COVID-19 pandemic in our region as well as in the country and throughout the world. We often look at history to learn more about the future. And so this evening we have Mr. John Berry, historian and Tulane professor and award-winning author of The Great Influenza, The Story of the Deadliest Pandemic in History, as our guest tonight. Mr. Berry, or as we discussed earlier, John, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you. A pleasure.
So, at least from the standpoint of Louisiana, you live in New Orleans, and it's been the city that's been most impacted by the coronavirus here in Louisiana. What's it like? What's it been like for you, especially being an author of pandemics and involved in this from the public health standpoint?
Well, you know, for 28 days now, the cases here have actually declined. The mayor was just on CNN making that statement. We were a hot spot, and I believe we had the fastest increase in the world at one point, but they did manage to turn it around. I live in the quarter. The quarter is very deserted. You actually do have some musicians playing nonetheless. The corner of Royal and St. Peter, there's a Ross's supermarket, and there's usually one particular musician outside there. And there is another musician up the street who plays quite frequently, Tim Laughlin, clarinetist. He gives sort of a concert in the late afternoon, and crowds gather there. Yesterday there was a coffee shop that has stayed open. And my wife and I go for walks every day. And actually in the Jazz and Heritage Museum on Esplanade, they have a balcony in back, and there was a concert that they were giving. It was a small crowd, properly distanced. And in fact, they were properly distanced from each other, but they were listening to that concert. So we still have music in the French Quarter even now.
I guess in New Orleans, you could consider music certainly an essential element.
Absolutely. That's certainly what a lot of people think of when they think of New Orleans. That and food, although I actually think the food here is overrated. But let's not get into that. I'll start.
Yeah, I think there are probably other shows regarding Louisiana cooking that we could segue into. From your standpoint, do you feel like the people in New Orleans were able to bend that curve down like they did in New York City by complying with public health recommendations? Is that how they did it?
Well, it's the only way you can do it. And you know, obviously complied enough that they were quite successful. The city will do a, you know, very much a phased, careful reopening beginning on Saturday. And hopefully that will go well. They do have, at least the mayor says, that in New Orleans we do have adequate testing and tracing capability. Or actually the tracing, I guess, is run by the state. But the she seemed pretty confident, and she's been extremely conservative, somewhat at war with the business community over reopening. I think she's done a good job. I think John Bell Edwards has done a very good job as well.
I'll just remind our listeners, this is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. I'm your host tonight. Our discussion is our continuing coverage of the COVID-19 pandemic. With us tonight, we have a special guest, Tulane professor and historian John Berry, author of The Great Influenza, The Story of the Deadliest Pandemic in History, as our guest. John, you know, from the standpoint of your book, I understand there was the most recent edition in 2018. I'm just going to read the first couple of words from the afterword. I think the afterword was a new edition for the 2018 edition of your book. And in bold print, it says in the afterword, "Events have overtaken this book." How would you describe your sentiment about that now?
I think the book's caught up with events, actually. You know, when I wrote that, and, you know, certainly part of the afterword changed, the last couple of pages are the same. When I talk about how important truth is and things like that, you know, the book came out in 2004, just as H5N1, a bird flu, was scaring people because it had a 40% case mortality and was threatening to become a pandemic influenza virus. I guess SARS had come and gone just before publication, but since then you had MERS, you had another. I mean, H5N1 continued to be a threat. You had Ebola. You had H1N1, the swine flu of 2009, probably the mildest pandemic in history. Then you have another influenza virus with a 60% case mortality rate, H7N9, that threatened to become a pandemic virus, and I guess actually still does threaten to become a pandemic virus. That would be a lot scarier than COVID-19. You know, that's what I was talking about when I wrote those words. Right now, we are obviously in the middle of a pandemic, early in the pandemic, not in the middle. We haven't reached the middle yet. And, you know, the lessons from 1918, I think, have been demonstrated to be very applicable. The viruses themselves have a lot of similarity, although there are a couple of key differences.
From what was the state of medicine like in 1918 compared to, you know, you talk about preparation and planning, right, in some of the lectures that you've given across the country about pandemic foretelling, and obviously your afterword in that book was somewhat foretelling. You know, they couldn't have been as prepared or obviously have planned in 1918 for a new influenza virus. What was the state of medicine like then, and how do we compare now?
Well, I mean, in the late 19, the book actually gets into the change in medicine. In the late 19th century, it was pretty bad in the United States. Medical education was downright pathetic. Even at Harvard, you could fail 4 out of 9 courses, get an MD. Most medical schools, the faculty pay depended entirely on student tuition, so they were eager to accept anybody who could write a check. Most medical schools, practically all of them, there was no one ever looked at a patient. All the courses were lectures. Even at Harvard and Columbia in the 1880s, which is well after Pasteur started his discoveries, nobody knew how to work a microscope, and there was no microscope at, you know, two of the premier medical schools. But that changed with the founding of Hopkins, and it revolutionized and changed medicine radically from the worst in the developed world to equal to the best. And in an incredibly short time. And by 1918, you had some great, great scientists working. He's a minor character in the book, but he gives a sense how good they were. A guy named Peyton Rouse won the Nobel Prize in 1966 for work he did in 1911. They won't give you the prize unless they know you're right. So it took 55 years for the rest of science to catch up with his 1911 discovery. And he wasn't alone. They were great scientists. They obviously didn't have the tools that we have today. They didn't have molecular biology. They knew viruses were really small organisms, but they didn't know if they were just tiny, tiny bacteria or an entirely different kind of organism. But in terms of planning and preparation, The Army Surgeon General, William Gorgas, who actually is kind of important in Louisiana history because of his role in yellow fever. He, you know, cut the deaths in Havana after the Spanish-American War to zero in yellow fever. And he allowed the construction of the Panama Canal by limiting yellow fever deaths there. And of course, yellow fever was a big deal in Louisiana, and 1905 was the last serious outbreak. But Gorgas expected some kind of epidemic disease, didn't know exactly what it would be. But he was very concerned and actually did a lot of preparation to try to prevent that. He was unsuccessful. In the talks that I've given in the last 15 or 16, after the book came out, I got pretty involved in pandemic preparedness, including working with both the Bush and Obama administrations. And I gave a lot of talks to people. But I would always say that planning does not equal preparation.
Right.
You know, we had the plans. You know, the Bush administration funded the development of pandemic plans. Every state has one, but that's not the same as preparation, as of course in Louisiana we know from, you know, planning for hurricanes and so forth, that, you know, you still have to execute the plan. The plan has to be a good one, but somebody has to go out and execute it. As you know, you and I were talking football beforehand, and you know, coaches are always talking about execution. So
yeah,
anyway, we have a plan at the federal level, but we have failed to execute it. You know, probably my role, if I made a contribution, the biggest contribution I made was in getting right, you know, the idea of telling the truth. Every meeting I was in, I would emphasize that it is written into the federal plan. And it's written into every state plan. But unfortunately, we haven't gotten it out of the White House.
On March 17th, in the New York Times, you published an opinion piece, "The Single Most Important Lesson from the 1918 Influenza." What was that?
Well, we were just talking about telling the truth.
Yeah.
You know, that for different reasons in 1918, they did not tell the truth. You know, we were at war, and the thought was that if you said anything negative about any subject, that would hurt the war effort. They created a propaganda infrastructure. There was actually fake news in 1918, but it was fake because most of the newspapers were complying with the wishes of the government. And either misleading or hiding, not publishing, whatever, but they were not really giving people the truth. And I think that led to unnecessary deaths in 1918. In fact, I'm sure it did. And it also led to chaos in a lot of cities. It led to panic in the worst places. It led to almost a fraying of society. And if you want, when you don't have drugs and you are going to rely on public health measures to try to contain an outbreak, and obviously we don't have drugs for COVID-19 at this point. We certainly don't have a vaccine for COVID-19 at this point. All you have is public health measures. So if you're going to try to control an outbreak strictly with public health measures, they're not going to work if the public doesn't believe in you or believe in what you're saying. And for a couple of months, we had someone who minimized the threat, and you had a TV network that largely did the same.
Yeah, it almost reminds me of how you've you know, compared and contrasted, let's say, the Philadelphia response to the San Francisco response in 1918 with a decentralization of, you know, public health measures? You think we've seen some of those parallels?
Well, we have, again, for, you know, for different reasons, but the results are largely the same. You know, in Philadelphia, they told outright lies. And as a result, there was, you know, I don't think it would overstate it to say there was a breakdown of society in Philadelphia. And there was panic. And, you know, most societies, most places come together in an emergency. You know, you routinely see the best of people. You know, I think I can't quantify it at this point, but in New Orleans and around the country, certainly around me, I've seen evidence of people coming together and helping each other. People who wouldn't necessarily normally help each other are doing that now. And that wasn't happening in Philadelphia in 1918. It was quite the reverse. People were actually starving to death because no one could be found with the courage to bring a family food when everybody was sick. There was plenty of food. They just couldn't find anybody to bring it to them. And there was, in the newspaper, repeated calls for volunteers. And finally, the person in charge of volunteer effort said, you know, issued a diatribe attacking her because nobody was coming out. She said women had the vanity to think that they were capable of great sacrifice. Nothing seems to rouse them now. By contrast, and that was because Philadelphia leadership simply lied to the extent that when they finally belatedly closed down you know, schools, banned public gatherings, and so forth and so on. They finally did this after there were already certainly hundreds and maybe a few thousand deaths. I can't remember the exact timing. One of the newspapers went so far as to say, this is not a public health measure. You have no cause for panic or alarm, unquote. I mean, how stupid did they think people were? You know, this is a time when people are dying in less than 24 hours. Sometimes with horrific symptoms that you normally would associate with a disease like Ebola, where people could bleed not only from their nose, but from their mouth and even their eyes and ears. This is scary. And you're telling people this is ordinary influenza, you have nothing to worry about, and that it's not a public health measure to close down everything. So all that did was cause people to lose any trust and authority, and not, you know, they couldn't believe anything they were being told. And that led to great fear and a much more chaotic situation. San Francisco, by contrast, which was very hard hit, was fourth or fifth nationally in terms of excess mortality, which was right about where Philadelphia was. In San Francisco, the medical leaders, the business leaders, the trade union leaders, and the mayor all got together and signed a joint statement that said, wear a mask and save your life, in huge print in the newspaper. And I don't think the mask did it much good. And again, the results, you know, the very hard-hit city in terms of deaths. But that's a very different message than what they were saying in Philadelphia, which is this is ordinary influenza by another name. It was called Spanish flu. And San Francisco did come together and did function and had no trouble finding volunteers, even for things like driving ambulances, which is risking your life effectively because you're or going in and taking corpses out of homes, which is certainly, you know, you would think you were risking your life to do that, or risking getting ill anyway, and yet they did have volunteers. And the difference was, you know, trusting the public, really. If you expect the public to trust you, you need to trust them. And you need to be straight with them. So the number one lesson coming out of 1918 was tell the truth. And again, if you're going to use public health measures to control something, if people aren't going to comply with them, then they're not going to work, or certainly not going to work as effectively.
And in your book, you know, not only with, you know, the leadership, the administration during the war, you even cite examples where certain army camps didn't even listen to the physicians that were leading the camps in terms of transferring troops in and out of camps. And so we have this political and public health divide. Rick Bright, you may have heard that name in news recently, came out as a whistleblower and predicted potentially that we're looking at the darkest winter in modern history. And so how would you compare and contrast the 1918 influenza pandemic to the 2019 COVID epidemic in terms of anticipated phases and making statements like that from a public health official in the face of opening society up economically for the late spring and summer?
Well, I mean, first, COVID-19 is not the 1918 virus, fortunately, because the 1918 virus was much more lethal. Worldwide, it killed 50 to 100 million people. If you adjust for population, that would be about 220 million to 440 million people today. So even the worst-case projections don't even suggest anything like that for COVID-19. By the same token, COVID-19 is more contagious than influenza, much more contagious than ordinary seasonal influenza, but even it's significantly more contagious than the 1918 virus was. So if you're going to infect, if the virus is going to infect 60, 70, 80% of the population, which it probably would if we did not intervene with public health measures, and even with a, you know, very small case fatality rate, if it's infecting 250 million people, even if it has a 1% case fatality rate, that would be 2.5 million people dead. You know, so we hope it's less than 1%. We hope it infects a lot less people. I guess I'll just wait for your next question. You know,
I guess from the standpoint of the Spanish flu or the 1918 flu, you know, in your book, you mentioned probably a smaller initial wave and then that large wave that came later, right, that really killed a lot of people. And then even a subsequent wave came about, which actually some element of herd immunity existed, right? So how does, you know, you mentioned we were talking at the beginning before the show started that we're sort of in the beginning of this pandemic, and people are sort of like over it already, right? Ready to be done with COVID-19.
Well, they're tired of it, yeah. 1918 was a little different. There was a first wave in the spring, but it was very spotty and did not get everywhere by any stretch. And in fact, only hit a minority of places, whether in the United States or worldwide. Western Europe was probably the hardest hit. But there are a lot of places in the world that didn't get to it all, and a lot of parts of the United States that didn't get to it all, probably a majority of it. And the virus seemed to, and it was also very mild at the first wave. Then the virus seemed to change and become much more virulent, and it did get everywhere in the world. I mean, everywhere. I mean, it got into the coldest regions of Labrador, the interior of Alaska, the interior of the Amazon, the interior of Africa. It got everywhere. And most of the deaths, probably two-thirds of the deaths, occurred in a period of about 14 or 15 weeks, September through December 1918. the funny thing, the thing is, if you did get sick in the first wave, which, as I said earlier, it was so mild, there were medical journal articles that actually said, this looks like influenza and smells like influenza, but it's not killing enough people, so it can't be influenza. However, you got immunity. It provided up to 89% protection against illness in the second wave. That is much better than the best vaccine we've ever developed for influenza. In the last 20 years, influenza vaccines have ranged from 10% effective to 62%. 62% is the best ever. Usually, if you're 40-45%. So this is 80. This illness in the first wave gave you 89% protection against the second. Then came a third wave. But neither first or second wave exposure protected against the third wave. No immunity whatsoever. That's because the influenza virus mutates so rapidly. It's why you need a new vaccination every year. COVID-19 does not mutate that rapidly. Number one, and maybe most importantly, there isn't the slightest hint, zero evidence, that this virus will become more lethal as it goes on, which is what did happen in 1918. And you can thank God for that. So set your mind at rest, I think, for that. And whether it's because of airplanes or not, this virus has gotten pretty much everywhere in the world. In most places where there have been lockdowns, which is, pretty much everywhere in the world, we interrupted the first wave. We stopped it. In Louisiana, we've really done pretty well. In New Orleans, we've done very well. There are probably still a few areas in Louisiana where it may be increasing. I'm not certain of the count in the last couple of days. But we've certainly done pretty well, better than a lot of states. And again, in New Orleans, done very well. It's definitely significantly downturn on that curve. But what that means is, we have saved lives by doing that. But we've also prevented the virus from infecting people. It's both a good and bad thing. The bad part of it is that it means this thing is going to last longer until we get a vaccine. Now, it would have lasted longer anyway. One of the biggest differences between 1918 or any influenza virus and this virus is the incubation period. Influenza is 1 to 4 days, and most people get sick at 2. This is COVID-19 is 2 to 14 days. Most people get sick at 5 or 6 days, which is triple long of the time. Influenza, generally, you're sick for 3 or 4 or 5 days. Sometimes the lingering recovery, but often people are almost fully recovered after a week. This disease takes a lot longer to go through the body. It takes several weeks. So everything is stretched out in this, beginning with the incubation period. And that has created a management nightmare. In 1918, or for that matter, a seasonal influenza, influenza hits a particular community, and it usually takes about 6 to 10 weeks to run through that community, and then it's largely gone until the next influenza season. This disease, even if we had not interrupted its transmission, which we did to save lives, and we did save lives, this would take much, much longer, even without interrupting the transmission. And that has put the stress on the economy, tremendous stress, and very difficult to deal with. But again, the lives saved were, if you look back to where we were like at the time that Trump really began to take this seriously, it was right around the middle of March. I remember it was a Monday. I forgot the date. It may have been March 14th or 15th. I think it was March 15th.
I think it was a day or so before you published your piece in the New York Times.
I think my piece came out on Tuesday or Wednesday, Thursday. It was a couple of days before, because I remember I had to revise a couple of lines in there. But at that point, there were about 100 deaths in the country. And 3 weeks later, there were 12,000 deaths. After we'd already, and the doubling time on the first week of April, when it was 6.5 days, we have slowed the doubling time to over 40 days. But imagine if we are at 85,000 deaths right now. Imagine if we hadn't slowed the doubling time. How many 100,000 people would be dead right now? And if we let, the original, right now, probably about 5% of the population has been infected. And we've got 85,000 deaths now, plus, thousands more in the hospital, some of whom will die. So if you just do the math, and you want to go to, say, herd immunity, which would require a minimum of 60% and probably higher than that of the population infected, and it's a simple equation. You're talking about over a million deaths. So that's what the economic disruption is saving. Hundreds of thousands of people, not a few thousand. And I know people are struggling. I feel it. And, I see it outside every day. I'm lucky I'm not. And I appreciate how fortunate I am. But it's difficult. And I believe that you do need to reopen. I think in Louisiana we are doing it the right way. The cases will start to tick back up. I'm virtually certain of that. But we're in a position to handle it, I think, here in this state anyway. People will die because of it. But you can't simply keep the economy closed down. And if you handle it properly, which I think we are doing here properly, you can minimize that toll.
What that brings to mind is that, there's phase one, phase two, and phase three reopening scenarios. And the natural history of viral disease, as was reflected in 1918, is the summer months you see sort of a waning of the infection rate, right? Its viruses are just not as hardy when there's more light, more heat, and so forth. And it could be that we do bring the curve down to get to phase two and then to phase three. And if those are spaced a few weeks apart through the summer, could we be artificially looking better than we really are in terms of containing the virus? And then the fall comes and we're fully open, but we're fully exposed as well.
Well, I mean, that's possible. You may be referring to another op-ed I wrote on a couple of weeks ago, April 30th. About waves, because we have artificially interrupted the transmission and stopped what would have been the first wave from spreading more widely, which again is a good thing. That leaves a very large susceptible population. And I do think that susceptibility is more important than seasonality. It is no doubt true that, we don't know for an absolute fact, but it's highly likely that this virus will be like other respiratory viruses. It won't survive outside as long in sunlight and high temperatures. That's definitely true of influenza. And almost, it's highly likely that it's also true of this virus, but we don't absolutely know. So that certainly would tend to tamp down spread. However, I think the fact that so many people are still susceptible to it is more important than that, and that the virus, you know, will, you know, spread, you know, if we're not careful, if we don't maintain the testing and contact tracing and so forth, then I think it, you know, still could explode. That's what happened in 1918. As I said a minute ago, we know for an absolute scientific fact that the influenza virus does not survive as well in summer as it does in winter. There's no speculation about that. But it didn't matter in 1918. You know, the second wave started in July in Switzerland, in the middle of the summer. And it ended in January in Australia, which in Australia is the middle of the summer. You remember earlier this year, we were hearing about record 110 degree days, you know, day after day in Australia in January. And 40% of the Australian population was infected. So summer didn't slow the transmission in Australia very much. You know, I think, you know, that people who are looking for much relief from the weather may be disappointed. But, you know, that doesn't mean that we can't keep ahead of the virus anyway. And, you know, the heat will have some effect. You know, what happens in the fall, you know, is unclear. I think, again, it's going to depend primarily on how we manage coming out of lockdown. If we have the tests in place, if we have the tracing in place, and I think we've seem to be in pretty good situation there in Louisiana, much better than most places, you know, largely because I think John Bell and in New Orleans, you know, the mayor has made a point of that, taking this very seriously, you know, then we can stay ahead of it. In terms of when the weather gets colder, will there be an uptick? You know, even that depends. You know, I think one of the biggest concerns is when you have two respiratory viruses circulating at the same time, that being COVID-19 and influenza. If we come back with another, you know, bad influenza season in the fall and winter, then you have a real risk of overwhelming your healthcare system. You know, any average bad influenza season very often closes emergency rooms and so forth all by itself. You know, we have expanded the capacity to take care of COVID-19, and hopefully it'll be expanded enough that we will be able to take care of a combination of influenza and COVID-19.
You know, that brings up a point that you mentioned in your book about the origins of H1N1, that it may have actually been an influenza virus that connected to another virus through a process called reassortment. And I know you're a historian, you're not a virologist, but, you know, there's some scary scenarios out there if you combine something as fatal as an influenza virus to something that's as efficient in being spread as a coronavirus.
Well, that's not going to happen. You know, they're different viruses, but in influenza is an unusual virus because most organisms have their genetic information on a continuous strand of, in most cases, DNA, but both coronavirus and influenza are RNA viruses, so it's on RNA. But influenza actually has its genetic information floating around on 8 separate strands. So if two different influenza viruses infect the same cell, it's called reassortment, as you said. It's like taking two different decks of cards, shuffling them together, and dealing out a new deck with cards from both of the other decks. That's reassortment. And, you know, that's when you get a new influenza virus. The 1918 virus, it's not clear. You know, all influenza viruses, all of them have their natural reservoir in birds. They're all bird flu, so to speak. And seven of the eight gene segments in 1918 came directly from birds. It looks like the eighth may have come from another mammal, in which case, you know, that's where the reassortment occurred in that other mammal, and then passed to man or humans, the he, she stuff. And it seems the speculation is the coronavirus also passed through another animal, probably something called a pangolin, but I don't think that's been absolutely established yet. This virus apparently can infect other mammals. It's not clear that those mammals can infect humans. In 1918, that influenza virus infected pretty much any mammal, including seal. We know it infected seals. We don't know for a fact that it infected whales, but we know it infected seals. It also infected tigers, cats, dogs, moose, horses, you know, everything, every mammal. And in 1918, we know humans gave influenza to pigs. So the pigs had human flu. Again, this virus, you know, it's not going to combine with an influenza virus. But
in terms of the origins of...
Yo, go ahead.
In terms of the origins of the virus, what's your take on, you know, there's conspiracies out there with regards to where it started. It seems like it's got a perfect profile for, you know, maximizing the terror in what... many people are asymptomatic and can carry and spread the virus a long incubation period. Is it your take that it's a naturally occurring coronavirus, novel coronavirus, or was it potentially manufactured?
It's not only my take, it's the take of the entire scientific community. You know, there happens to be a Tulane scientist, Robert Gary, who's an expert on coronaviruses and track down SARS, and, you know, every scientist, and I mean just about every scientist, recognizes this is a naturally occurring virus. And even the Trump administration, which is not trying to sell that it's a man-made virus, you know, they're just arguing that without really any evidence that they've displayed that it escaped from a laboratory, you know, an accidental release from somebody being careless in the laboratory. You know, there are, you know, people on the Senate Intelligence Committee, you know, where's your evidence? You know, they're just making a political charge. You know, it's not impossible that that could happen, but there's no doubt that it's a naturally occurring virus. And even if it was an accidental release, it's not, you know, which is all they're claiming now. I mean, it wasn't part of a plot. You know, the Chinese have not exactly been forthcoming on all sorts of things regarding this virus. They have not behaved well. But remember, they wrecked their own economy before anything else happened. And they took measures that we would not even begin to tolerate in the United States to try to limit the spread. I mean, they physically locked people in their homes, locked them in their homes, where if they had a fire, they couldn't get out. You know, you could, I mean, that's, they were taking just very extreme measures, you know, so. Anyway,
yeah, they pretty much buried their curve pretty quickly, at least in Wuhan, and then as things were relaxed a little bit, cases started popping up again. This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. Our topic tonight is continuing coverage of the COVID-19 pandemic. Our guest tonight is Mr. John Barry. He's the author of The Great Influenza. John, from the standpoint you mentioned the Trump administration, you know, one of the fascinating things I found about your book was, you know, many of the parallels between the public health response and the political response. And as you know, there have been cases of the coronavirus in the White House. And from what I read in your book, it actually did touch the very upper part of our political spectrum in terms of Mr. Wilson's response and then actually what happened to President Wilson at the end of the pandemic.
Well, in the third wave in Paris during the negotiations for the peace treaty, a young member of the U.S. delegation died, and Wilson got very, very sick. And, you know, I think it affected the peace treaty. He was, in 1918, you know, reviews of the scientific reviews of the symptoms and the complications and so forth concluded, as one of them said, second only to pulmonary difficulties were neurological disruptions. The people whom Oliver Sacks wrote about in The Awakening were supposed to have been, we hypothesized they were victims of the 1918 virus. It's, you know, strongly suggested by the evidence that people became schizophrenic as a result of the 1918 virus. It is beyond dispute, as that review that I just quoted said, second only to pulmonary were neurological, is beyond dispute that people were seriously disoriented, their minds didn't function properly in all sorts of ways when they were sick and immediately after they were sick. And in Wilson's case, that happened to be one of the complications. Everybody around him, from Irwin Hoover, who was the White House usher, although he was in France with Wilson, to Herbert Hoover, who, of course, later became president, and who was part of the, he was around the delegation trying to feed much of Europe. Everybody commented on how disoriented Wilson was, how his mind was affected by the virus. And he was conducting some negotiations, actually from his sickbed, with the British Prime Minister, Lloyd George, and the French Premier, Georges Clemenceau, whose nickname was the Tiger. So you have somebody physically weakened by influenza, mentally disoriented by influenza, negotiating with somebody whose nickname was the Tiger. Before he got sick, Wilson was adamant that all the principles that the United States, that he had articulated the United States was going to war over, what he called the 14 points, that all those principles had to be included into the in the peace treaty. And it was basically what he wanted was, much like Abraham Lincoln after the Civil War, he didn't want the South punished. He wanted it reunited. Wilson didn't want Germany punished. Frankly, Germany, you know, they may have launched an attack, but that war was won. It wasn't a good versus evil kind of war. And, you know, he wanted people around the world to be able to determine their own fates, what, you know, is anti-colonial, all sorts of things. Wilson was regarded around the world almost as a god because of the principles that he had articulated. And he was adamant that all those things be included in the peace treaty, until he got sick. And after he got sick, he caved in on practically every point. accept the League of Nations, which was a moan that Clemenceau threw to him. And, you know, the peace treaty took territory, German territory, away from Germany, gave it to France, forced Germany to pay reparations, and is just about unanimously regarded by historians as a significant contributor to the rise of the Nazis and eventually then to World War II. Now, somebody could argue that even if Wilson had never gotten sick, he would have caved in just the same. And maybe that would have happened. I don't know. But the fact is, he was holding firm, even threatening to sail back to the United States without a treaty before he got sick. And after he got sick, he caved in. So.
And he survives, but as we know, has a stroke, which is not uncommon after coronavirus as well. And there goes the League of Nations, right?
Yeah, cardiovascular complications were extremely common after not just the 1918 pandemic, but after ordinary seasonal influenza. It definitely has can create cardiovascular problems.
This is a listener-supported Red River Radio. If you have a comment or question for Mr. Berry, the author of The Great Influenza, we have maybe time for one call or question, 1-800-552-8502. You know, going forward, John, what do you expect to see in the coming weeks and months as the country, you know, attempts to reopen with the current pandemic that we have? Do you see, you know, you mentioned NPI, non-pharmaceutical interventions, and how you've worked with administrations on pandemic preparedness. Now we're in the middle of this thing. What do you foresee in terms of NPI? We don't have a vaccine. You know, the development of a vaccine, development of treatments, as well as what you write about in terms of our just-in-time economy. Is it going to be able to catch up?
Well, I think, you know, we have it within our power to determine how deadly this virus is. If we, you know, I know we're coming out of lockdown, and I don't oppose that. At least in this state at this time. There are other states where I think it's premature. But you still have to maintain social distancing. It's still better to, I guess the slogan in New Orleans is safest at home. It's not ordering you to stay home. But, you know, if you minimize your contacts, that's better. And if you are going to be around people, if you maintain the 6 feet minimum, and that's a minimum, if you wear masks, you know, if we have contact tracing, then we can do this, get the economy restarted, and not suffer, at least not suffer much. If people get lazy, it's not a question of laziness. That's not fair. They lose their concentration. Let's put it that way. As we were talking off camera, you know, you played football. I was a football coach. And there was a time that I had one practice when I got mad because we weren't doing jumping jacks right. And I decided it was a point of discipline, that there's a reason you do jumping jacks. And if you don't do them right, then you're not going to get the maximum benefit. Everything we did on a football field, there was a reason for it. So we ended up spending an entire practice one day doing jumping jacks because I wanted us not only to do them right, but to drive into the players' heads that you have to attend to detail, you have to be disciplined at all times. If we can maintain discipline and sustain compliance with these things, then we can be in pretty good shape. I'll give you a more concrete example. That may be funny talking about football, but here's a real one that matters. into people's lives. The very first meeting in the George W. Bush administration we had about planning non-pharmaceutical interventions, they flew over the head of the infection control at the Hong Kong hospital that had the best record in terms of healthcare workers not dying from SARS. A lot of healthcare workers died from SARS. And it was hypothesized that maybe a lot of them died because when they didn't protect themselves properly when they removed their personal protective equipment. There was no shortage of that equipment, but when they were taking it off, maybe they got sloppy and infected themselves. There are other ways they could infect themselves as well. And this guy said, every hospital in the world, or at least every advanced hospital, knows how to do infection control. But the reason healthcare workers at other hospitals died and healthcare workers at his hospital did not die was because he insisted and it got it ingrained in their heads to do the fundamental things right all the time, every time. And they lived and other people died, not because they did anything that was magical. They were just more disciplined. And that message has really struck home with me. Maybe it did because of football. When he was talking about that, I kept thinking about Vince Lombardi blocking and tackling and stuff like that. You know, you win football games when you block better than the other team and you tackle better than the other team. Forget about all the X's and O's and fancy stuff. That's what wins football done, is doing the attention to detail, doing the things right all the time, every time, not most of the time. So, again, if we come out of this with discipline and sustained compliance, we should be okay. If we get sloppy, then there's every possibility this disease will come back and make what we've already gone through look like child's play.
Mr. John Berry, thank you so much for joining us tonight on Health Matters. We really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. It's been fun.
I'm Dr. Randall Brewers, and that's our show for this evening. You can find more information on COVID-19 at coronavirus.gov. This program will be available for podcast at www.redriverradio.org. You can also find updates on COVID-19 for Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas on our homepage. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Thanks to Kermit Poling and Wally Derleth for providing assistance this evening. Views and opinions expressed on Health Matters may not reflect those of the station, LSUS, or its staff. Health Matters has been made possible in part by the Noel Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you so much for being part of our audience this evening. And turn in next Thursday as we continue our special Health Matters coverage on the COVID-19 pandemic.
It's all right, it's all right, for we've lived so well, so long. Still, when I think of the road we're trying.